Hello everyone, welcome to the Lisa Burke Show, and I'm delighted to say we're in a new studio, so the camera angles are better, we've got lots of microphone capacity, and it really is a pleasure to be here with you in Advent times, in the run-up to Christmas. And with me today I've got Ambassador Barbara Karpetova, who is the Czech ambassador to Luxembourg. And it's a thrill to have you here in the studio. And we have a very special topic because it's really bringing the connection of the Czech Republic to Luxembourg with a very special person that not everybody in Luxembourg, not alone Luxembourg, maybe across Europe, perhaps the world, they don't all know about him, but certainly in the Czech Republic, this person is very, very well known. So we're going to step back about seven centuries to meet one of the most extraordinary rulers in European history and has profound Luxembourgish roots. It's Emperor Charles IV, son of John the Blind, considered the greatest Czech. That's in fact, right. And a visionary monarch whose values still resonate today. And we're going to dig into those values. It really was through education, diplomacy, multicultural openness, stability, and building rather than destroying. So, Ambassador, it's great to have you here to discuss Charles IV.
Thank you very much for inviting me in such a special time, talking about the star of a Czech history, a person who is beloved up to now.
Yes, because in fact, you wrote to me to say, in fact, of all of the people through Czech history to date, he comes out number one, still, seven centuries on.
Yeah, isn't it unbelievable?
It's quite a legacy.
It is. And I would even add that in the country, as my home country, where people tend to be rather critical, it's even higher achievement than one can imagine. I would say Czechs are very careful with authorities, and to become the most popular monarch of all time, it's one thing, but to become the greatest Czech of all and to even bear the title Father of the Fatherland, well, that really means something.
And it really was through his mother's line that he was Czech. So
And imagine he was half Luxembourg.
Half Luxembourgish through his father, John the Blind, who was known as King of Bohemia, a legendary knight across Europe, but not quite the stable personality of his son. So it flipped. So perhaps let's go back there. Let's go back to where Charles, and that wasn't his first name either, where he grew up. So Charles, father John the Blind, and his mother was Elizabeth of Bohemia. So let's start with his parents.
His parents. Well, there is quite an interesting constellation in the family. Some would call it a very heated relationship. On the other hand, if it comes to history, we know that a lot of royal families had their up and downs.
And any family, I would add, actually. But yeah, royals also.
No one's spared. And John, when he arrived to Prague, where he was asked to arrive as the King of Bohemia, was only 14 years old. And Elizabeth, one of two surviving sisters of a previous royal family, was 4 years older than he was. And being 18-year-old girl, I think she already had a lot in her mind. And she was that time with, I would say, much better vision what she wanted. For John, it was a first big international revenue. It was something what his father sent him for and agreed for. And surely it wasn't easy to come to the country he's never been before. He didn't know anything about the customs. He didn't know the language, even though two of them spoke German and Latin, so they were able to communicate.
Well, at least that's something for a marriage.
Yes. Well, maybe it would have been better if
without,
they didn't understand each other.
I'm still trying to envisage this 18-year-old Elizabeth, and she came from a very long line in, well, Bohemia as it was then, or a lineage, an ancestral lineage of royalty. And then this 14-year-old boy turns up. I mean, an 18-year-old girl and a 14-year-old
boy, I would call him.
Yeah. The other time I went to the European school here in Luxembourg, and I was trying to explain how difficult it was for John. And then I realized there are children sitting in front of me who are in their age. So I called 14-year-old boy and 18-year-old girl. And all of a sudden you could see, like, oh, gee, wow, that was...
really, you know, really hard.
That was the way, yes.
It was the way, because it was so important to forge these alliances.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There was a lot of political background, and John's father, Henry the Seventh, was the Roman king. Hence, obviously, there was a vision for future that his son might take the title later on. And Bohemia was a very rich country of that time because of the silver mines. Mm-hmm. Hence, I would say that when John arrived, from the very beginning, silver, money, and the wealth of the country was on the table. And that means a lot of other subjects to be interested in. Hence, the Czech nobles obviously divided as well. There was a bit of a war between the queens, the Queen Widow and Elizabeth. There were people on both sides which hoped that their alliance with the right side can help them. Usual thing.
We should probably say we're talking about the 1300s, yes, here, 1400s, yes, period of time, but really the 1300s. So Charles IV was born into a lot of instability. And at the age of 7, he was actually sent away to France. So again, a great linguist, plenty of languages needed to be learned by somebody of his stature. He spoke many of them, but France from the age of 7 to 14. So he was raised really in the French courts.
That's very correct. Before he was sent, though, in the age of 3, he was separated from his mother. And that was one of the consequences of, let's say, disagreements between husband and a wife. Hence, if I put it in the, let's say, nowadays psychology, a child being 3 years old, separated from his mother completely and never saw her in his life.
Again, yeah.
And then taken from the environment he at least knew a little bit about to a completely different culture again, though it's important to say that John, his father, was very much connected to the French court. He was brother of the French queen by that time. Hence, Charles went to see his aunt. And it is important as well to say that he was very much welcomed. The French king saw maybe some, you know, direct lineage in him. He definitely took care of him. So let's say that from not very friendly motherhood, he went to a very friendly fatherhood.
But his mother really, I mean, she suffered hugely, hugely herself. Not only did the child suffer, but she also suffered emotional breakdowns, humiliation, even imprisonment, isolation. So her life was not a happy one afterwards either.
The thing is, life had to be a hell. It was not just her son who was separated from her, but 2 of her daughters as well. So there were 3 children taken from her. And she was, I mean,
and whoever's
why? Got children. Well, because there was the suspicion of, and I would say that not surprisingly, these things were happening, that she would become, let's say, something like a regent of the young prince and pushed his father, her husband, completely out of the country and then ruling the country on her own. It isn't so surprising that, you know, a certain circles around her were definitely pushing or poking her to do so. And John, on the other hand, had a lot of people around him to try to persuade him that this is definitely her intention. What was in her head, we will not learn anymore. And but what were the consequences for children was rather tragic. And she died quite young. She is buried in Bohemia. And it's important to say as well that after years and years, when Charles came back to the country, the first place he went was a grave of his mother.
It never left him, clearly, and I think that that link in his mind, and again, we can never know his mind, but obviously that affinity was just inbuilt in him, and the giving back to his mother's land, the motherland, really, that was part of his life's journey. So coming back to him then, and let's just also set out a different part of history at the time, which is the Roman Empire at the time, because this it becomes very, very confusing, and yes. And religion plays a part here too.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Roman Empire was definitely in one of its difficulties, and I think it can be even called crisis, because there were two popes later on, even three popes. And Charles, in fact, later on tried to avoid with his golden bull any situation which could have been, taken again as the basis for the similar problem.
I want to just come back to that, because that's something that I hadn't known about till I did research, the golden bull. This is very, very important to explain, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm not a historian, so let me explain it in a very, let's put it, simple way. So the golden bull brought on table a number of procedures which would avoid problems with voting the next Roman emperor. And what Charles brought, and mind you, these rules were applied for 400 years again, hence there had to be something about them, the number seven. Number seven, and interestingly enough, four of them being rulers, three of them clergy. So that is very, I would say, surprising, because Charles was seen as a devout Catholic and someone who very much allied with the Catholic Church. Though, for the Golden Bull, it was written down that there are four monarchs, and I'm sorry, I'm not able to bring all of their titles now, and those seven men becoming the most powerful votes for the next future Roman emperor. And it really worked. It did.
And then, I mean, again, Italy, let's move into Italy then, because obviously all of the borders were quite different back then. But at the age of 14, I think his next destination was Italy. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it was Italy.
It was.
I was trying to follow his geographic path.
Yeah, he was jumping like a frog. So from Prague, going to Paris, getting his education, and then his father decided, being 14, the same age as he was when he went to Prague, it's already the time to prove himself.
And I shouldn't have said Italy, it was Lombardy, because Italy was, of course, very much not Italy. Italy is quite a new country in the context of what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's complicated. It's 700 years ago. Yeah. and as we all know, borders are quite flexible in certain times. Hence, he arrived to Italy, and the first thing which happened was he found out that his colleagues, the people from his group, were poisoned. So he was apparently not very welcome. John sent him to claim the duties, the taxes, the rights he had in Lombardy. And 14-year-old Charles probably did not recognize at the very beginning that would be a part of his mission.
But did he feel, because of his religious connotations and notions and feelings as well, the fact that he survived and was not poisoned, that was a sign of something?
There were several things he realized in Lombardy, things that Lombardy had some, it had really impact on him.
I survived, number one.
That was, it was definitely number one. And he he truly believed it was the God's will to you know, help him. But the second very important part was that he had a dream about an angel taking him to the battle and showing him as the French dolphin of that time sinned in a, let's call it, sexual way. Mm-hmm. And the angel punished him with killing him, piercing his private places.
And it's a terrible dream. I would call this quite a bad nightmare.
It was really something for Charles, who woke up.
Maybe he was poisoned after all.
Well, he definitely had the situations in his experience in Italy to be worried about. I think it was a lesson from his father to show him, you know, the other part of the life, not just the academic and educational. And his father definitely introduced him to some more earthy pleasures on this world. And Charles freaked out after this dream. He told his father, that's why we know about it, because it was written down. And he said, and I'm sure, you know, he paid for it, and I am never ever going to sin that way. And alas, what happened after about a few hours, there was a messenger coming announcing that the French dolphin really passed away. So he had this dream which was fulfilled, and I guess it helped to you know, give him a sign that there is a higher power than the earth power. And he very much later on in his life tried to follow what he was told.
And he also really tried to analyze, self-analyze. But we will come back to that, because first of all, let's go back to his father. His father's life was quite different. It was unstable. He was a great warrior, and he died in battle, actually, as well, in a very famous battle.
Yes, the Battle of Crecy. And probably because of the English Lobo. It seems, even from the anthropological research, that it was the arrow which ended his life. Though, in some...
Because actually that war, again, I was doing a little bit of research for this, and I learned a lot. I think that was the, apart from World War II, when the troops came over to Brittany, that was the largest insurgence of British troops into France at the time.
Yeah, it was a part of 100-year war between England and France, and French lost a lot. And there is, though, a suspicion that John knew what he was doing, and that was, in a way, let's call it, knightly suicide mission. He was blind by that time. He really couldn't see. And he ordered two of his knights to lead him to the front line. There was no way he was able to survive that.
Yeah.
He prohibited Charles from taking a part in it. So he already knew that was his last battle.
And why this son? Because Charles also had a brother who ended up being more well-known, I would say, in Luxembourg, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But he already had his sights set on Charles as being the person to take over.
Charles was the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
Charles was the oldest. That's why his name when he was born was Wenceslas. People might know it from the Christmas Carol, mm-hmm. Good King Wenceslas, who was not really the king, it was a duke. We're talking about 800s. And that duke became a martyr. Martyr killed by his own brother, who disagreed with you know, the lead of the politics. Duke Wenceslas was heading to. And by the way, this is the saint patron of Bohemia. Mm-hmm. And this was someone who Charles endlessly praised, and definitely had him as a very special a role model, I would say. And John, by that time, knew that he was not able, because of his handicap, rule the country either. So if you imagine a man who was in his entire life to be associated with the Buttles and the knightly, I would say, virtues, and now he was not able to go to the Buttle and really helped. I think from what I read and what I've heard, that and a lot of leaders in military have this dream. They want to die with their soldiers. I've just, read some of the memories of General Patton, who at least wanted to be buried with his soldiers. And he is buried here in Luxembourg. So John went to the Buttle with a very very clear idea that he wants to die as a knight, and that really happened. And funny enough, or interestingly enough, it brought him closer to his son's heart, because he valued him. He really cherished in John this charisma, this courage. Charles himself was pretty courageous, but
in a very different way.
Yes, very different way. And he admired it. And his, bravery in the battle and the decision really made Charles to write later on in his biography that his father died as a knight, and that he died as a great warrior. And then there is one more important thing, especially for the Czech history, and that's why even though he was, let's say, not taking care of the country as much as the locals would appreciate, his last words were legendary. He said, there's never been a day when the king of Bohemia would leave the battle. So this huge part of bravery, courage, and the knighthood, he connected with being the king of Bohemia.
This is John.
And that's why, he got all his glory.
Well, that was an excellent final line.
Yes.
And of course, You've mentioned a few times now, the reason we know quite a lot of this history is because I believe it was Charles IV who documented extremely well what happened in his life. And those documents are available. You've got a fabulous website where people can literally go back and see these documents. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's called Manuscripto.
Well, manuscript means that it was written by hand.
But the website, I think, is...
But most of it was really written by Charles himself. Only, let's say, and we're talking about 200, 250 pages of the medieval format. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's very unusual that the medieval monarch would write himself. They usually had the people. They had people who wrote chronicles, people who wrote diaries, but not quite often they would write it himself.
It's reminding me of social media today.
Yes.
It's almost self-promotion in a different form.
You can say so. And plus, as I said, he wrote it himself. Mm. It's obviously a bit of a political summary of what he's done, why he did it, what was, his mission. But at the same time, there are, surprisingly, quite a few personal, even emotional, and a kind of describing details. And he wrote about his father. He wrote about him. He did not forgive him for what he's done, when he was like a little child. He wrote that was like the darkest time of his life, and he could never forget that. He had a trauma. Apparently, he had a trauma as well, being separated from his mother. But then, step by step, he was, I would say, coming to peace with his father, recognizing how very difficult to be a ruler himself. and what compromises and what, you know, variety of the stabs and what dangers as well he faced himself. It was not the first and not the last time he was assassinated in Lombardy. It happened several times. So I think step by step, he came to the knowledge that his father just tried his best.
I think the skeletal records show that he had an injury to his face, in fact, which isn't shown in the portraits of him or the sculptures of him in various places all around the Czech Republic, Prague. So let's just go on to say what there is available to anybody who visits Prague. And I'm sure Christmas time is a wonderful time to visit your beautiful homeland, which I've yet to go to. But we have Charles Bridge, we have St. Vitus Cathedral, we have the new town of Prague, we have castles, fortifications. So he was everywhere. And perhaps most notably, and we'll come to this, education. Education was really, really important. So unlike his father, who was this charismatic warrior and knight, Charles went in a completely different way, but his vision has remained.
He was a builder. He was a builder. And I think it's one of the main characteristics which people would remember about him, yes, because of the places we can still see. So whoever comes to Prague will obviously cross the Charles Bridge, will see Charles Square, Charles Street, Charles Quarter, Charles, a part of a town named after him. He was an urban planner, and this is and Karlstein and Karlsbad. You can see the man was like branching wherever it
was possible. That's right, because he was also known as Karl.
Yes. And that is something, and I think here he definitely inherited his father's charisma. He was able to motivate people. He was able to inspire them. So a lot of artists from all over Europe, and architects especially, came to his court and started to embody his visions. Why he had those visions? Well, once he wanted to restore, let's say, the kingdom, which was not in a very good shape because most of its money went to the battles. That's what his father definitely left behind himself. Charles was a visionary and someone who wanted, and that is quite unusual for the ruler of the medieval times as well. He wanted well-being for people. He really cared about people. He was a leader.
How novel was that? Because nowadays, of course, we hear this a lot, but even in my own lifetime, this seems to be quite a new concept, the well-being of people in the workplace or at home.
Definitely.
So what was it like back then, the concept of the well-being of the citizen?
Mm-hmm. Well, what he started to do, and I mean, how funny, it's very much linked with nowadays problems of a society's lack of the living places. There were not enough living places in Prague. Hence, we're talking about the entire urban development. He wanted artists, he wanted scientists, he wanted people, you know, from the crafts to come over, but he needed places for them to live. As well, he was able to bring the social projects. So one of them is called Hunger Wall. And he said, okay, I do understand that, you know, there are poorest of poor, and we need to strengthen the fortification. Whoever's got hands and legs, come, help, and I'll feed you. You know, monarchs usually, the medieval times, tend to say, well, I want it to happen.
Do it.
Do it, exactly.
And he cared dialogue
as well. He cared, you know, how to make it. This next step, that is something what is very typical for him. He really had a ability of reflection. He was permanently asking himself, And he meditated a lot. And during those times, he was asking himself, how can I make it, you know, better? Is this what God wants me to do? Is this the best way how to do it? Very, I guess, modern type of approach in psychology.
It's extraordinary, actually. And the other thing he brought was really the first university in Central Europe, 1348 Charles University. So alongside all of this and his own reflections, he was giving to his people the chance to rise up and to be educated. And he was really refining the city around him and making Prague a metropolis of the times. And also this also has some history when it, in connection to the Roman leadership at the time, because Rome at the time was a bit of a mess. So people were coming to Prague more and more. It became a pilgrimage place also.
There is a bit of, I would say, French history in it too, because Charles, being educated at the French court, was extremely lucky with his tutor. His tutor later on became Pope Clement, and he really embedded the love for education to Charles. And I think he found in himself at you know, his teacher Pierre that time, this wise father he very much wanted to have. And when he returned back to Prague and had already the powers, because that was not from the very beginning, to decide things himself, it was one of his first decisions. He wanted to have university. And again, here comes Pierre, that time already the Pope, and giving him a permission to do it. It's not just like that to found university. He needed a permission. And
which also shows the strength of the papal kingdom at the time.
Yes, of course. And that is the competition. So I'm pretty sure that Sorbonne was not that happy, you know, to have all of a sudden competition in the Central Europe. But he got the permission and he created what is up to now known as the oldest university in Central Europe. Sometimes they say north from the Alps, because in Italy there were very, very old universities as well. And yes, and there were four sections: German, Italian, I think Polish and Czech, because in Poland there was no university by that time either. And students were coming to Prague, and there was the international education, obviously masters, how they called that time teachers, were very welcome. They knew that that's the king's project, hence supported. And Prague's university, Charles University, became really a symbol of Charles's approach to education and his wisdom and vision, because it's working up to now.
It's extraordinary, really. And it also, given the four sections you've just talked about, reminds me so much of life in Luxembourg, because it's this multilingual, and he was, of course, multilingual. And he brought on board all of that in his teachings, in his, the way he ruled, actually, the multicultural capacity. I think it just shone through all of his values. And that was really quite unique at the time.
Well, you know, that is one of the things and one of the reasons why I'm here, because I know that not that many people in Luxembourg really know about him and maybe are not realizing that he was, from nowadays point of the view, the most successful Luxembourg's monarch at the medieval history. Not only that he is so much praised in my country, but from a variety of the angles. He is a pure embodiment of this country and its values even nowadays. Multiculturalism, multilinguistics approach, are very good at diplomacy. At the same time, you know, able to come and say, okay, enough is enough, and now we want this and that. Someone who's so much in DNA of nowadays Luxembourg that that's striking.
His leadership at the time is quite different, though, compared to other rulers. I mean, he was a real diplomat and a pacifist, and his leadership was entirely different to that of his father's. Where did that come from?
I wouldn't say he was a pacifist. At the times when it was necessary, he sat in front of his armies and he went to the battle. He really inherited from his father a love to knighthood. He even later on in his life crossed the red line, and as the monarch, he went for a tournament and he injured himself badly. And that was one of the things he was not supposed to do. He went far from Prague because he was not he didn't want to be recognized. And during the tournament, he was injured because he wanted to stay, hidden, and he nearly died. He was paralyzed for several months. He had a terrible injuries as well, you know, in his face, and terrible pain. And the way how they were fixing him already at that field, Jesus Christ, can't really imagine. So I wouldn't call him pacifist. But at the same time, he preferred diplomacy, and he was very smart in persuading people. And that might be as well a part of the charisma he inherited from John. John was seen as a persona. Wherever he came, people were falling for him. And Charles probably inherited this type of a magnetic personality. And he was able to persuade people to do what he wanted without fighting them.
Mm-hmm. And he traveled around a lot as well. He was somebody who didn't send his messengers because he was so multilingual. He showed up in these places.
Yeah, he really wanted to know what's going on. And he was able. He spoke and he wrote. That's very important too. 5 languages. He was obviously very fluent in French. He was fluent in German, in Latin, in Italian. And he relearned Czech when he came back to the country. He forgot it in his childhood, but then he learned it back. And what was written in the Chronicles was that he was not only fluent, but he was really like a native. So it came back, this memory.
He was very clever man, obviously, as well. So if one can put ourselves into his mind at the time, what do you think he wanted for Europe at the time?
For Europe? Well, he was definitely very proud of his Luxembourg's heritage. He's mentioning this many times in his biography. He understood perfectly that there is a lineage, that there is a legacy, and that there is, mission. So he was on mission, and, you know, as problematic relationships he had, and one of them with his father, he understood which house he comes from. He visited Luxembourg several times. And he stayed here in a certain moment, not long enough to know the country, but he mentioned it in his biography. And he really derived his right for the throne from his father. Though he could see, and I think this is something what John and his father, Henry, saw as well, Luxembourg and Charles Bohemia are part of Europe. He was truly European. His ideas about Europe being interconnected were, nowadays we would call him a person who definitely wants this continent to be united.
And then you mentioned before his reflections, his awareness of his own motivations and that time taken away to meditate and to reanalyze his choices. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a little bit missing from some leaders today. Where do you think this came from?
Well, that might be, in fact, his mother's side. His mother was seen as a very religious person, and there is, as I spoke about Saint Wenceslas, this very strong lineage from Saint Wenceslas as a patron, saint patron of the country, and Saint Agnes as well, being a religious princess. And Charles definitely had a strong faith, and I really mean faith. It wasn't just because I'm the monarch, I need to be seen in the church. He truly believed in the God's leadership. And not only that, he later on, as being the Roman emperor, built a castle called Karlstein. It's very much recommended for those who had a chance. It's one of the jewels of my country. And he used Karlstein not only as a safe for the Roman royal coroner, crown and a scepter and the
various other relics. There was relics was a big thing at this time.
That's right. But these were the royal jewels of the Roman emperors, and plus relics. Mm. He was a big collector. He loved collecting relics, and Karlstein was the place. But even more connected with your question, he used it as a meditation place. Women were forbidden from Karlstein. No woman was allowed to enter, even the queen. He had the chapel, St. Catherine's Chapel, in the middle of the castle, and he laid for hours and hours and hours in there on the floor, and he was reflecting, meditating, praying, and I think trying to find the sense of the soul. St. Catherine was his favorite saint. He was he received his knighthood on the day of Saint Catherine, and he prayed to her.
This is fascinating. I'm trying to think of a leader who would be a rather busy man taking time out to lie down, prostrate in a chapel, and to take that time out to meditate and reflect. It's quite a powerful message, actually.
It is. And I think that, you know, whatever you call it, meditation, you can call it relaxation, you can call it whatever,
prayer.
I think for it gives a very strong, I would call it even a recipe for people who have a huge responsibility on their soldiers and on their shoulders, and their soldiers as well. It's the seems like, you know, this kind of a stress needs to be released somehow. Unfortunately, Charles the son was releasing much of this stress in alcohol and some other entertaining activities, but Charles found this type of the meditation as the method which led him up to this wisdom, right? Wisdom. How do we reach the wisdom? Well, he found his way.
Well, he certainly did, because he remains a symbol of hope and goodness and a light and the greatest Czech ever in 700 years. So what enduring values do you think we could think about from his leadership, his wonderful leadership in some ways? I mean, nothing's perfect, but he certainly left a great legacy that could help leaders today.
Yeah, that's a difficult question. And, you know, there is no universal recipe. I think Charles had to make his mysteria and went through his labyrinth himself. And as we can see from his childhood, it was not an easy journey. If you imagine, even from nowadays' point of the view, a child who went through this type of really like a family drama and a zillion of the changes and attempts of his life, we could have expected that he would turn into maniac, which would take revenge on everyone who was around. Definitely, we can expect that the person like that might turn rather harsh, maybe even cruel. And Charles was known for being a very open and friendly person. Not that he wouldn't, you know, from time to time come to the conflicts with people around, but he was seen as a very generous monarch. And it is obviously a combination of his character, of his heritage, of his maybe even DNI he inherited from his parents. But at the same time, it seems that the mission and vision he had and the ability of the reflection kind of created a persona. Yeah. I think if the leaders have the vision, if they at the same time stay humble enough to take time for the reflection of their deeds and words, and they remain to like people, because that is probably the most important thing after all. I mean, this love they are able to show in variety of the steps, should it be through building, should it be through education, should it be through just being generous, friendly, open, nice, and having this on mind as much as the fate can intervene in it, I think that those people stay in human minds as good leaders.
Yeah, and it's such a great message for Advent, which we're in right now as well. And then he's remained this strong personality, so beloved, so relevant for Europe today. And then I'm trying to think if there's a message that we could leave our listeners and viewers with for this period of Advent, which is often one of reflection, if one has the time to step away, because everybody's life seems so intensely busy. Yeah. And to find those pauses seems something like we were saying before, I pressed the record button, to find that pause to kind of reflect on what we're doing. It's not easy to find those moments.
Definitely, yes. And it's everyone's responsibility, you know, to stop in a time and they say, hey, you know, have I done everything I could for the best result? I would love as well to leave the message for your Luxembourg's listeners that this was their countryman. It was a man who elevated Luxembourg for duchy. It's someone who...
That's right, he gave it the title of duchy.
Yes, the title of duchy. And he definitely felt like a member of a Luxembourg's dynasty. And I would love to raise the awareness, because at the same time, it's such an incredible success story of a member of, well, that time, not insignificant, but maybe not the great power, becoming in four generations the leaders of Europe in many ways. And I think it's a good point how to look at Luxembourg. Even though it's not huge, it gives through the values, which I think Charles was a perfect embodiment, motivation and inspiration for the leadership. I think it's very important for people in this country to realize they've got these abilities. It's a part of your DNA. And it is something what the other world is, you know, valuing, cherishing. And as you can see on the other side of Europe, in my country, a long time ago called Bohemia, now called Czech Republic, we cherished that for 700 years. That means something.
It just also shows the collaboration that is possible if one has that mindset, the collaboration across Europe, through countries, through different leaderships, to bring people together. And of course, you know, we were talking again off air about other situations in the world, which are ongoing and are absolutely tragic, absolutely tragic. And not everybody is going to be able to enjoy a period of Christmas in whatever way one may celebrate this restful end of the year period. But it's certainly an end of a year is a period of reflection for most people. And for most people, a time when they come together with their families, they take a few days of rest at some points. But what I think his values have embodied is a life of service to his people. I think he took that on board very strongly. He had a religious North Star. Mm-hmm. For him, this was something that was very important. Multiculturalism, that shared love across different cultures. And the languages, of course, helped him immensely there as well, which is something we see every day here in Luxembourg. Yes. And I think he really lived the vision of the European Union.
He did, he did. And I'm sure that, you know, if we would ask him, well, Charles, well, how can you see yourself in the nowadays? Oh, well, might be the very charismatic leader of the European Union and might be the unifying leader of European Union. And that is something what we need very much. We need a charisma. We need a people who believe in a mission, and we need a people who feel the duty and know that they want to do the best.
And finally, for those who are lucky enough to go to Czechia, the Czech Republic, at any point this Christmas, what could one look forward to and what should one visit?
Well, there is absolutely no way to escape, Charles. Wherever you go to the centre, you will see the landmarks, whatever is there from the Gothic times. Should it be on the main squares? Should it be at the cathedral, St. Wenceslas Chapel? Should it be just the coronation route, which Charles himself went through? You will see him by the Charles Bridge. There is his huge statue. And that is Charles, you know, welcoming you in there. And I think the more you learn through what you see, the more of the interest you make the appetite for. And really sort of like would be able to learn more and more and more about the man who was a miracle.
Well, thank you so much for bringing our attention to somebody who's half Luxembourgish at least, and definitely half Czech, and telling us about your beautiful homeland. And we wish you a wonderful Christmas ahead. I know that it's hard as in your first year as ambassador here in Luxembourg to get a moment of rest, but perhaps we can all imbibe a little bit of Charles IV's philosophy of meditation and reflection and take a period each day to think about which direction we should be moving in, walking in, and whatever our circles and paths in life. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for giving us your time today.
Thank you very much, and I wish you Merry Christmas.
Thank you.